Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at KSFR.org, podcasting at SantaFeRadioCafe.org, thanks to Dot Foil Computer Services, and we're at Facebook.com/Radio Cafe. I'm happy now to welcome Michael Jensen. He is with Amigos Bravos, which is a statewide conservation organization that's concerned with both the cultural and environmental aspects of water conservation. And he is here to give us an update on all the different things that are going on with Amigos Bravos. Welcome back to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte. It's been, I don't know.
A year?
Yeah, maybe.
It's been a while, but it's very important for people to know about the work you're doing, a lot of which goes unreported or under the radar. But one of the things that you were doing the last time we talked was just monitoring water in the rivers above and below wastewater treatment facilities and so on, and in the waterways of our state, which provide our drinking water for various chemicals.
Right. We have this project down in the Middle Rio Grande that operates from Algodones, which is a little bit north of Bernalillo, at the Angostura diversion, where the water comes out of the river and into the drains and ditches, all the way down to the I-25 bridge. So we monitor the drains and ditches on both sides of the river at 8 sites. And we're looking at metals and nutrients like nitrogen and ammonia and stuff like that, and pharmaceuticals. And that was the big story last year, is that we found pharmaceuticals at the 3 sites that we sample for them at the Angostura diversion, in the middle of that whole reach at the National Hispanic Cultural Center, and down at the I-25 bridge, all along what's called the East Riverside Drain, basically.
What were some of the pharmaceuticals that you found?
We found acetaminophen, which is, you know, in Tylenol. We found caffeine, which is used kind of as a marker because it's easy to find and doesn't break down. We found the active ingredient in a lot of sunscreens, insect repellent, DEET, the chemical that's in insect repellent, some anti-seizure and behavioral related drugs, things like that. And that was in March. We got those results back, and that was really surprising because we wanted to sample for them because they're what's known as an emerging contaminant, these pharmaceuticals and personal care products, and there's very little monitoring done for them. And
their effect on the environment is yet another story.
It's pretty well established by both field and laboratory experiments that they have an impact on, and not just experiments, but actual results out in real rivers, that they have an impact on fish, amphibians, things like that. So, for example, back east, one species of fish, 80% or more of the males had eggs. So
because of these estrogen products.
Right. It's especially within this group of pharmaceuticals, there's a subcategory called endocrine disrupting compounds that impact the hormone system and confuse it. So there are other examples of frogs and other things that change sex while, you know, because of this, and things like that. So we were looking at those, and one of the things that we sample for about 26 or 7 pharmaceuticals. One of them was an endocrine-disrupting compound called bisphenol A, or BPA for short, which is used in plastics and also in the liners of cans that hold food and stuff like that, if you notice that sort of creamy-colored lining inside.
Yeah, which looks very nice and sterile and
yeah, neutral and all this. Right, exactly.
In fact,
yeah, the kind of color you'd put on the wall of your house to make it, you know, neutral and pleasing to everybody.
Right, and put your art up on it. But we did a show on the movie Tapped, which was about the many different hazards of plastic water bottles, and that was one of the chemicals that they were talking about.
Yeah, I think in Nalgene bottles, and the manufacturer said that they would stop using it. But we didn't find it in March when we were sampling, but in June and October, at the site where the I-25 bridge goes over the river and the drains, below the Albuquerque Bernalillo County Water Utility Authority's wastewater treatment plant, we found it. It showed up in both June and October. So that serves an update. And coincidentally, just yesterday, the EPA has decided that they will add BPA to a short list of contaminants that they want to take a closer look at. You know, the evidence isn't conclusive, but there's enough evidence in their estimation to warrant investing some funds into doing more research. And that also follows up on a decision by the Food and Drug Administration earlier in the year that also said they thought that there was some concern and that they were going to start to talk to manufacturers about the use of BPA in areas where it could get into the food supply.
So like BPA is not good for you.
Well, there's conflicting studies, like there are with a lot of these things, because the research is just getting started. You know, different studies look at different things or have different, you know, some of them are small scale, some of them are larger. So with the BPA also, some studies on laboratory animals have shown an impact, some other studies haven't, but in the estimation of these two agencies, one dealing with food, one with the environment, there's enough evidence to warrant each of them taking a harder look at this and trying to make a determination about what's going to happen with BPA.
And so that is something that has been found here in New Mexico in the rivers at the locations that you're talking
right.
about and is cause for concern.
Right, because Albuquerque is already getting its drinking water out of the river, a large percentage of it, and ultimately hopes to get maybe as much as 90% or more of its drinking water out of the river. Santa Fe is going to be turning to the river. And BPA itself is very widespread in its use and in detections other places in the when people look for it. It's relevant to the Water Utility Authority down in Albuquerque because there's a citizen group down there that's concerned about the drinking water and who's specifically asked the Water Utility Authority if they've ever found BPA, and they said no. But in our first attempt to find it, we found it.
Okay, so this is something that we will continue to follow up on.
We're sampling again this year. We just started a week ago. We were out for a week sampling at the 8 sites. We should get those results back in a couple of weeks. And then we'll go out again in June and October this year and see if, you know, what we find. So that's one issue that's been in the news, you know, that news story that just came out.
Now, there is another set of updates that I want you to let us know about, which involves Los Alamos National Laboratories.
Yes. About a week ago, there was a story. It was in the journal, at least, and it announced that the Los Alamos National Laboratory Natural Resource Trustee Council, which is made up of a bunch of federal agencies, the Department of Energy, which is the owner of the lab, Department of Interior, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, the New Mexico Environment Department, and the Pueblo of San Ildefonso, lately, just recently joined by Santa Clara and Jemez Pueblos, that Resource Trustee Council issued what's called a pre-assessment screening, which means that they think that there's enough evidence to show that LANL has caused damage to natural resources and to the pueblos that a full-scale damage assessment process, a damage assessment plan, should be developed.
Now, has caused damage over the course of its entire history, or is in recent times, or what?
Yeah, the legacy of Los Alamos National Laboratory's operations from the beginning, that impact to the environment and also to the surrounding pueblos, their ability, for example, there have been complaints for a long time from the pueblos that sacred sites have been harmed or that they're not trustworthy anymore because they could be contaminated, things like that. And so basically what's going to happen now, the next step after this pre-assessment screening, is that they'll do this process. This whole thing is under the CERCLA Act, which is commonly known as the Superfund Act. So the next thing they'll do is look at the different pathways that damage could have been caused, you know, air, soil, water, things like that, determine if injury has been done and how great that is and what sort of damages might be awarded to those that have been harmed by the pollution, the contamination. The one thing to say about this is that there hasn't been any public participation in that process. It's just been between state and federal agencies and the surrounding pueblos. Where the public has been involved is that starting some time ago, and I have to sort of give kudos to Concerned Citizens for Nuclear Safety, because after the Cerro Grande fire in coming up on a 10th anniversary in May, CCNS, Joni Ahrens, really made a big deal about the fact that the fire exposed a lot of soil and that there could be runoff down into the river or down the canyons and then getting into the groundwater, and that it really needed to be taken seriously. And she's made a big deal about this. She brought Amigos Bravos into the process back in 2004. The two organizations did a study on stormwater discharges at LANL. That led to two parallel processes. One is that in this time last 2 years ago, in March 2008, members of an organization that we all helped found called Communities for Clean Water and some other people and organizations filed a lawsuit against LANL for Clean Water Act violations related to stormwater. And then for the past year, we've been in negotiations with LANL and the EPA over a stormwater permit that the EPA Region 6 office wanted to issue.
What is stormwater?
Stormwater is when melting snow or rain runs across the surface of the, across the land surface. And in the case of Los Alamos, runs across there and then goes down all the canyons that run down from the Pajarito Plateau and down to the river, or run down part of the way down the canyon and eventually trickle out and infiltrate the ground and get into the aquifer.
So it's what we might call also runoff.
Right, it's runoff.
We're talking to Michael Jensen of Amigos Bravos.
So there was this permit from the EPA Region 6 office, and we had participated in trying to get that to be a good, strong permit, and we weren't satisfied. We and others in Communities for Clean Water weren't satisfied that it was strong enough, held LANL accountable enough for making sure that that runoff didn't get into the environment, that we appealed it administratively within EPA, and that led to a long negotiating process, and about 10 days ago, a week ago, last Friday, that was all resolved. Everybody agreed, and there's a much stronger permit. It's so much different from the original one, in fact, that EPA is going to hold new public hearings on the permit.
On the new permit.
Right, on the new permit. And then sort of, like I said, there was the lawsuit too, but now that it appears that the permit issues are resolved, we'll have to see what happens in the hearings, public hearings and stuff. We're sort of shifting over to seeing if we can, all of the parties, Los Alamos, us, the EPA, can resolve the issues in the litigation, in the lawsuit, this Clean Water Act lawsuit.
Which would be very nice, because litigation is expensive and time-consuming,
right,
whereas proper permitting.
And the longer things are in litigation, the longer it'll be before stuff is actually done. So if we can get all of this resolved soon, then, LANL and the federal government and the state can all focus their attention on cleaning up the lab. I mean, they're supposed to. They signed a consent order with the state a while ago. They're supposed to be completed in 2015. They've only got five more years. They're supposed to do a fence-to-fence assessment and deal with everything up at the lab. This is just added pressure. And so we sort of have this coalescence, it seems like, right now, with the stormwater permit being resolved, being able to focus attention on getting the litigation negotiated, this new report from the Natural Resource Trustee Council saying there's so much evidence that there were damages that we're going to push ahead with trying to quantify what those are and what kind of award the lab should pay out. So
now, the Natural Resources Trustee Council, that's not a citizens group.
No, it's several federal government agencies, the Environment Department here, and then the three surrounding pueblos, Jemez, San Ildefonso, and Santa Clara. So it's all government entities.
But I
really firmly believe that the fact that citizen groups for the last decade, and especially for the last, say, 5 years, but with the creation of Communities for Clean Water and a lot of other citizen input, and pressure on Los Alamos, getting the word out to the media, mobilizing the public, has really had an influence on things like this report. Because in the past, you know, the lab has denied that it has any responsibility. They actually, in the story that just came out about this report, they openly acknowledge that they created problems for
and
the environment. So.
It's interesting because the kind of common wisdom about it is they just, during the Manhattan Project and afterwards, they just threw stuff into the canyon not knowing what they were doing. But it's hard to believe that they didn't know what they were doing.
They say, in the past, you know, there have often been quotes from people at the lab saying that, oh, you know, back in the old days, we didn't know better. And then, you know, environmental movement started and there were new regulations and then we started paying attention and we've really cleaned up. And yes, things are better than they were in the old days. But back in the mid-40s, shortly after the lab got going, in the, say in like 1946, 1947, there are memos from lab scientists to lab management saying, we're really concerned that all the stuff that's going into the canyons could get into the groundwater, could get into the river. So, you know,
right.
People knew.
Right.
So they just there was a different mindset and a sense, I suppose, that dealing with the environment, you know, would just slow them down or something. I don't really know. They have done better, and you know, these negotiations that I've been talking about have involved a lot of give and take, and so there has been a lot of, you know, willingness on the part of staff at Los Alamos to sort of grapple with these issues and try to get some kind of resolution. And like I said, you know, we have a much stronger permit than originally, and the lab has signed off on it. So now we just have to see what would be, what's really critical to this whole effort is citizen monitoring and watchdogging. Be able to continue that there, ideally, you know, there'd be some kind of funding set up to do this kind of independent citizen-based monitoring of what's going on up there to make sure that things get carried out, that the permit is being held to, anything that comes out of the lawsuit is followed up on, things like that. Because, you know, we know that, you know, if people are left to themselves, you know, they have a tendency to slack off. It's sort of human nature, and so you've got to have people looking over your shoulder, kicking your butt every now and then. So that would be a really good outcome.
We're talking to Michael Jensen of Amigos Bravos, which is a statewide river conservation organization. So the thing that we're actually here to talk about, that was just an update. There is another whole set of hearings that are coming up on regulations of the dairy industry.
Yes. This is actually something that the industry itself started. Well, yes and no. A couple of years ago, there was somebody wanted to set up a dairy. It's called the Parasol Dairy down in the Caballo area, right near Caballo State Park, which is Caballo Lake is just below Elephant Butte Lake or Reservoir. And an individual, a citizen down there, Jerry Nivens, and others, but, you know, he talked to his neighbors, and there was sort of this feeling that there was something going on, but nobody really knew. And Jerry just started driving around all the roads and back roads, seeing what he could find out. And one day he came across what constituted public notice at the end of a dead-end road, out in the middle of nowhere, basically, that said, there's going to be a dairy here. And that concerned him because of what he started to find out about how shallow the groundwater was, how fast that water was heading towards the river, the fact that there were state parks in the way of that water, that it's in the middle of a huge floodplain that collects sometimes enormous volumes of water that would just wash across parts of where the dairy was planned to be.
Now, are dairies very polluting types of industries?
Dairies, especially what are called CAFOs, you know, concentrated animal or confined animal feeding operations, you know, where you pack a lot of animals together in a small area. These aren't, you know, just cattle free-roaming.
Right?
Yeah. They generate a lot of manure, a lot of waste, tens of thousands of gallons of it every day, and it has to go somewhere. know, there are various ways to deal with it. You know, sometimes it gets spread as fertilizer on crops, but the tendency, because there's so much of it, is to dump way too much on the crops, which leads to, when rain and stuff comes across, it gets carried away and dumped places where it shouldn't go, in streams or, you know, lakes and things like that.
In theory, it's a great idea because it's a natural fertilizer.
Right. And, you know, nobody's quarreling with that idea. And it's, you know, it's organic. It's not made by, in a chemical plant, you know, so it has some benefits.
Unless, of course, they're eating
right.
That's
the issue.
Hormone-laced.
Especially, you know, in the area where he might be applying it, the kinds of crops that are grown down there where it might be applied, a lot of them are things like onions and chili and things like that that typically aren't processed. You know, much at all. You just buy them the way they are. They get rinsed or something, but, you know, they're not really washed or, you know, processed in a way that would get rid of stuff. And so, I mean, that's why there was a fear that we'd have, you know, like a situation like in California where there are all these recalls of produce that have been contaminated with salmonella or E. coli or all this other stuff. So just a lot of concerns. And Jerry started talking to his neighbors, talking to local media, talking to the Elephant Butte Irrigation District, the local Bureau of Reclamation people, and nobody was really aware of this dairy going in, which was a real failure of the public notice process, for one thing. And the tide started to turn, and what happened, beyond anybody's expectation, especially Jerry's, was that the Environment Department denied the permit. It was the first dairy permit in New Mexico to be denied. And it's still in appeal, and that the new hearings will be held in May sometime. But what that led to is that in the 2009 legislative session, there was a bill introduced, Senate Bill 206, that said that agencies, you know, environmental agencies, couldn't put conditions on permits if there wasn't specific language in statutes that apply to dairy specifically, because the legislation specifically said that it dealt with the dairy industry and with copper. And there are reasons why copper was in there too, but we don't have to talk about that. So that it was an effort to sort of very narrowly limit the scope of what an agency like the Groundwater Quality Bureau could do with dairies. And
in other words, to favor the permitting of dairies.
Right. If the idea from the industry side was if there wasn't some specific language in the regulations, in the statutes, pertaining to the regulations, that the agency could, or the Water Quality Control Commission that signs off on these permits, you know, they could be rejected by, you know, the industry. Just go back and say, no, show me where the language in the statute is for this condition. So it would just narrow the ability of the department to do, say, site-specific permits and say, well, in general, you know, what you're doing is okay, but there are some specific characteristics of your site, and we want to put some conditions on the permit to make sure that you don't pollute the, you know, groundwater, surface water, whatever. And there was some hesitancy in the beginning from the environmental community that, you know, this could be a bad thing, but there were some who saw perhaps an opportunity to get something good done. And, you know, the bill passed, and starting in spring, there were a series of community meetings around the state with, you know, members from areas where there are dairies, from the dairy industry, and the Environment Department, and so on, and the department issued a draft set of regulations in the summer, and then there was a follow-on set of what were called stakeholder meetings in the fall last year, which involved Dairy Farmers of America and Dairy Producers of New Mexico and this sort of umbrella organization called the Dairy Industry Group for a Clean Environment, which has now become the lead organization There was the Environment Department represented by the Groundwater Quality Bureau, and then there were some community and environmental groups. There was Jerry Niven's group called Caballo Concerned Citizens, another organization called Citizens for Dairy Reform out of Hobbs. There was the Rio Grande chapter of the Sierra Club and Amigos Bravos. And there were a lot of meetings, a lot of, you know, back and forth about what, you know, the dairy industry wanted or what they were complaining about in these proposed regulations. And there was a lot of push from us to get them even more stringent than what the Environment Department was proposing, especially in a few key areas. So essentially, you know, the dairy industry made it clear that for all existing dairies in New Mexico, they didn't want any new regulations put on them at all. They don't want monitoring wells if they aren't already there. They want to be able to put clay liners everywhere.
What are clay liners?
To collect all this huge amount of manure and waste from the animals, you have to build these big lagoons, impoundments, and they have to be lined with something. And the what the dairy industry wants is to have no requirement to put any kind of liner except it's a compacted earthen bottom that has clay added to it. And if the local clay, if there is any available, isn't sufficient, to have some additives, you know, sort of imported additives like bentonite clay and things like that that compact really heavily mixed in. So they're not pure clay. They just have enough in it to minimize the amount of seepage. But there's no way that you can make a clay liner that doesn't seep. So
right.
They're basically designed to seep at a rate that doesn't exceed a certain amount.
And
they're only about a foot and a half thick.
Does the clay supposedly absorb whatever might be toxic in the cow sewage?
No. It's just designed basically to slow down how fast stuff seeps out of the bottom and sides of these impoundments.
So are you trying to make it so that there is regulation on existing dairies?
Yes. We want, as soon as an existing dairy's permit comes up for renewal, they come up every 5 years, or if they make any significant modifications, and so they have to get a modified permit done, anytime their permit is dealt with, we want the new regulations to apply to them where it's relevant.
And the dairy industry doesn't want that.
No, they don't want it. But here's a fact. This comes from the Environment Department. Based on their own records, two-thirds of the dairies in New Mexico are already violating the groundwater quality standards for just for nitrates getting into the groundwater. If you add violations of other standards, you know, the number gets bigger, but nitrates is the biggest one. So, you know, the dairy industry is trying to claim that, you know, they don't cause much of a problem, and the Environment Department's own data shows that, you know, most dairies pollute, and we're just talking. This is just groundwater pollution, and we're not talking about, you know, data on pollution to surface water, or let alone all of the airborne stuff that gets out there.
What kind of airborne stuff?
Well, you know, down in Las Cruces, where there's this thing called Dairy Row, where there's just like dairy after dairy after dairy, and down in the Mesilla Valley, there's a lot of concerns about asthma, let alone nuisance from flies or the smell or stuff like that. And there are even...
Or methane?
Methane's another issue from these things, you know, as a greenhouse gas.
Yeah.
That's not even on the table
okay.
right now in these negotiations. But it's, you know, just the airborne stuff alone is enough of a concern that even among, you know, in academic circles where there's a lot of sympathy for the dairy industry, I mean, these are people in academia that do a lot of consulting for the dairy industry and stuff, there are big studies being done on airborne contaminants, how far they spread, what impact do they have on surface waters, on human health, on things like that. So
all of these things basically haven't really been addressed or aren't being followed in the state of New Mexico, and now they're up. Now they're being discussed.
Right. The Environment Department's proposed new regulations are much stronger than what the dairy industry wants. And then we're adding even more stringent things. So we want to have, we support the Environment Department on, pushing for synthetic liners everywhere because they're much better. I mean, they can always fail. I mean, no technology is perfect, but they're much better than having clay liners, for example. But we want to add to that, we want, for example, to expand the list of things that the Environment Department wants the dairies to sample for in their monitoring wells.
There's
a very small list that the Environment Department is proposing. The dairies would prefer not to have monitoring wells at all because they say they're too expensive. But without monitoring wells, you don't know if they're polluting, and if you don't know they're polluting, then the Environment Department doesn't have a basis for intervening.
Right.
So it's a circle, right? We want to have larger setbacks so that the dairy facility is farther away from
schools.
Any sort of public buildings, things like that. But and then have a special setback for rivers, lakes, parks, things like that.
Right.
On the order of ideally, several miles, and not a few hundred feet or 500 feet or.
Well, because of
the
nature of the flow of water.
Right. Exactly. And then the big thing that we've been pushing, Amigos Bravos, within this whole process is that we want the dairies, this comes out of our experience working with mining companies, we want the dairies to put up what's called financial assurance at the time that they file for a new permit, if it's a new dairy, or like I said, when existing permits come up for renewal or modification. We want them to put up financial assurance, and there's lots of different ways it can be done. It could be cash. It could be a bond. I mean, there's lots of different ways it can be done. It doesn't really matter particularly. But to guarantee that there will be some money there to close out the dairy when they're all done, to make sure that the impoundments are drained, everything that's in them is disposed of properly, ground
when the dairy
is re-sloped.
Closes.
Yeah, when they're all done discharging. Because, the experience with mining companies is, they get everything out, they're done making a profit, they shut down, they say, oh, we don't have any more money, we can't really clean up, and they walk away.
And they leave a huge mess.
They leave a huge mess.
It's a story that we hear over and over and over, the privatization of profit and then the socialization of cleanup.
The dairy industry says that it's not a big deal that, dairies clean up after themselves, but at the same time, they're complaining that they can't bear the cost, the supposed high cost of these new regulations because they're fragile economically. There could be because of low milk prices, and they could, there could be bankruptcies. And so our response is, well, if you guys are so worried about your industry that you're worried about a wave of bankruptcies, then we really need to have that financial assurance in place. And it's not a huge amount of money. I mean, they and the Environment Department both say that it doesn't really cost that much to actually do the cleanup, but typically, when a dairy does go bankrupt, they have a lot of outstanding debt and very few, resources because if they've gone bankrupt, they've let their facilities go. They haven't done the maintenance they're supposed to do, and so it's not worth that much.
I mean, basically, what is their collateral? Cows?
And, the infrastructure, the barns and stuff like that, equipment.
So what is the public's role right now in participating in this whole set of questions?
Right. So the hearing, there's the hearings in front of the Water Quality Control Commission are scheduled for to start on April 13th, and they're scheduled to run for several days. And all of us, you know, the dairies, the community environmental groups, and the Environment Department have all already submitted their written testimony about why they think their, you know, each of our proposals warrants merit. And then we've all submitted what's called rebuttal testimony. We're responding to, you know, the others. And so that's all out there. You know, at the hearings, each of us, you know, the environmental groups and the Environment Department and the dairies will briefly summarize their testimony, and then there'll be questioned there. But the public can come and, you know, state their reasons for why they support, you know, stronger dairy regulations. And there's a lot of opportunity at the Water Quality Control Commission for the public to do that. They, you know, the Water Quality Control Commission realizes that, you know, the public schedule, you know, isn't as flexible as ours is necessarily. And so if people show up and they want to talk, you know, they can get scheduled in. What people can do is, if they want to see what the Environment Department's proposals are, they can go to the New Mexico Environment Department, to the Groundwater Quality Bureau, and look at that.
They can just go to their website.
To their website. And they can go to the Amigos Bravos website.
Which is amigosbravos.org.
Yeah, exactly. And take a look. The Water Quality Control Commission, they should have sometime soon, if they haven't already done it, a lot of that, all of that testimony and rebuttal up on their website. That's what they did during the triennial review of water quality standards, so everybody can sort of see what's out there.
So if anybody has missed all of this, because there's people going to work listening to this program right now and so on, they can go to the amigosbravos.org website and check it out, and then either write to you and ask questions or take it from there.
Right. They can go to the website. They can call the Taos office at 575-758-3874 and talk with Rachel Kahn, who's taking the lead on this for us, and she'll help people, you know, coordinate their testimony. All of our work, you know, all of the community environmental groups, all of our effort is being coordinated through the New Mexico Environmental Law Center, and thanks a lot to them. They, you know, without them, it'd be a lot harder for groups like us to do what we're doing.
And that they're also on the web, New Mexico Environmental Law Center. You can Google them.
Right. The other thing that people can do is to write letters to the Water Quality Control Commission urging them to support the community proposals for the new dairy regulations. And what they should do is send an email to the hearing officer. That's Joyce Medina. And her email address is Joyce, J-O-Y-C-E, dot Medina, M-E-D-I-N-A, at state. Dot NM, you know, for New Mexico, dot US. And just, you know, thank them for having the hearings and ask them to consider, you know, your opinion on the matter.
So, once again, for anybody who's missed any of this, they can just listen to this podcast again at santafe.radiocafe.org, or just go to amigosbravos.org.
Right. And on the Amigos Bravos site, we'll have, you know, a fact sheet with talking points and, you know, a draft letter that people can modify, you know, with their own experience. And
exactly. Michael Jensen is with Amigos Bravos, which once again is a statewide river conservation organization, on the web at amigosbravos.org, and that you can reach them by phone at area code 575-758-3874. Thank you so much for being with us, and it's great to have this regular update.
Thank you very much.
We're going to take a break right now. We'll be back in a moment. Please stay tuned. I'm very happy now to welcome Elliot Schmidt. He is on Governor Richardson's Special Economic Development Task Force. He is actually new to Santa Fe, new to New Mexico. He's come here from Washington, D.C. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Well, thank you, and I'm happy to be here.
And I would like to welcome Pat Ajarian-Lopez, and she's with the New Mexico Tax and Revenue Department. Welcome, Pat.
Glad to be here.
Now, we are talking today, we've got just a short time to do this, but we are talking about the budget gap. New Mexico had its legislative session. There was a lot of talk about closing the budget gap. Where are we at?
Well, right now, we have taken some measures, as you know, to address the budget gap, but we're still projecting a possible $300 million shortfall for our budget this year.
So that basically has to be made up by either cutting the budget more or raising revenue.
Exactly. And there really are not a lot of areas for budget cutting at this point. We've cut everything as much as we can. The only area where there might be a little room is perhaps more furloughs. We're thinking of five more furlough days per year per employee, and we are encouraging state employees to think of this as a vacation. You can take all 5 days in 1 week if you like and have a nice vacation this summer with your family.
So, Elliot, you are here from Washington, and we've been talking about some interesting ideas that are coming actually from New Mexico's burgeoning film industry.
Absolutely. You know, the governor, as you well know, is very eager to build the entertainment industry in New Mexico.
And has been doing so for the 6 years that he's been in office.
And he currently is building partnership with the Mexican government to promote Lucha Libre wrestling in our great state.
This would be an economic development partnership to promote Lucha Libre. That's like that professional wrestling that they do in Mexico.
Kind of, but with masks. They're very excited with that. We have corporate sponsorship and some Lucha Libre celebrities on board.
So what would that actually look like here in the state of New Mexico?
Well, we have a three-pronged strategy. We're looking at closed-circuit TV, sports bars, and live performances. We probably at first regulate it to the major cities like Santa Fe and Albuquerque, but we hope to expand to, you know, smaller and more remote venues.
Pat, what kind of taxes are we looking at? And I know these would have to be approved by legislators in a special session, but there were certainly lots of questions about the food tax and other kinds of taxes before the food tax was vetoed. What taxes are we looking at now?
One of the things that we're recommending to the governor and the legislature is a 20% surcharge tax on all purchases of guns and ammunition in the state of New Mexico, including transfers among private citizens.
How much revenue do you expect to raise from that tax?
From the transfer of the weapons themselves, it is not significant, perhaps $1.2 million, but the ammunition surtax we expect to raise approximately $30 million.
And how would you regulate transfer between individuals?
We haven't gotten all of the details worked out, but we are working with the major telecoms to come up with a GPS-based system.
Now, I know that another consideration comes from actually the tourism department, and there are some considerations of loosening of certain restrictions that would affect the border areas.
That is correct. You're very well informed, as always, Mary Charlotte. One of the big parts of the New Mexico economy has always been tourism dollars. We have always depended on tourism dollars, and these days some of those dollars are pesos. There are quite a few well-to-do Mexicans who would love to vacation here and are put off by the stringent border requirements. So we are looking, we're working with the Border Patrol people and the federal government to loosen those restrictions so that there is more free travel across the border.
And, of course, there's a large number of middle-class Mexicans as well.
Absolutely, and we hope to attract them.
Elliot, you are also working with various energy projects. Of course, that's part of the green economy.
Absolutely. The governor is very enthusiastic about any alternative energy programs we can implement in New Mexico, and he had this great idea, and I am completely on board, which is to implement small hydro projects throughout the state, but not on a kind of a macro scale, but more on the individual consumer, that they can get subsidies to start their own projects.
Help me out here. How would that help the revenue of the state of New Mexico?
Well, we are always on the border of an energy crisis. And this way, individuals can produce their own energy. And given a sufficient infrastructure, they can sell the energy back to the utilities. So they're making money, we're saving money on energy production. It's a win-win situation.
Now, DWI is an often talked about problem, driving while intoxicated. A lot of legislation, a lot of talk has happened about this issue. What role does DWI play in this conversation about revenue enhancement?
Well, first I need to back up. It isn't just DWI. An increasing problem is what I call DWNPA, which is driving while not paying attention. Now, we have attempted to, you laugh, but it's caused quite a lot of fatalities.
What, cell phones?
Their cell phones are a big part. Cell phones, texting, you know, fighting with your kids, trying to put makeup on, reading. I've seen people reading the paper while they're driving.
No, you
these
have
are,
not.
I have. These are all very serious problems. So what we would like to do is we would like to look at expanding the same sorts of penalties that are associated with DWI to these other issues. There are fines now for using a cell phone, but there are no serious penalties, no possibility of jail time or having your vehicle taken from you. So we are looking at that. And then in addition, what many people don't understand is the cost of taking these cases to court is immense. It clogs up the system, and then we can't use the courts for things that they really need to be used for. So what we would like to institute is pay-as-you-go checkpoints, so that if you get pulled over for one of these violations and you don't wish to contest it, you may pay your fine at that spot. We will be able to take credit cards, debit cards, and cash, no checks, of course. And if you pay at the time that you are arrested, there is a 10% reduction in your fine and a 1-point reduction in the number of points on your license.
Very interesting.
Because there is, of course, a shortage in officers, we will be privatizing this service to private security firms who will handle all the administrative costs and all the personnel and will turn over a percentage of the revenues to the state.
That's a little scary. I mean, we've talked on this show about Blackwater, and those companies are very expensive.
They are, but they're also very efficient, and we feel as though if it's good enough for the federal government, it's good enough for us.
So, Elliot, there is another idea that would involve New Mexico State Parks. I'm not sure. You tell us the details.
Well, the governor thought that we need to involve the citizenry in some of New Mexico's greater projects. So the idea was that we would have locals vote on their favorite state parks. And the one that received the least amount of votes would be sold for development. And not just are we getting rid of a burden on the state budget, but we're providing much-needed jobs in the state.
Now, wait a minute. This is, I don't know. I mean, development, that's something that, I mean, the state parks are precisely there so that we keep those lands pristine and not developed.
Frankly, there are more state parks in this state than there are cities and people. Do we really need that many? How many state parks have you visited this year?
Good question. It's almost time to go, but are there any other considerations on the issue of taxation?
One thing we had considered is there's a large untapped and untaxed market in adult companionship services, which I believe would create a nice synergistic relationship.
Wait. Adult what? Adult companion services?
Yes, you know, for instance, a lonely businessman here on a trip who wants company going out to dinner or a show and doesn't really want to go by himself may wish to have a fresh young companion to while away the lonely hours. And these services are very highly remunerated, professional services, but are currently not being taxed. And this is a great source of income, partly because it does come from out of state. We're bringing revenue from Texas, from California, from Arizona, from other places, and they're spending the money here, and the state would like to have its share.
And you know what I have to say? When I was being vetted for this position, I took advantage of those services, and I have to say, they are top-notch.
Pat Ajarian-Lopez is with the New Mexico Taxation and Revenue Department. Elliot Schmidt is with Governor Richardson's Special Economic Development Task Force. Thank you both so much for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dot Foil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. We're at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, jazz. Have a great day.